Welcome to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Ever since Amazon announced in September it was looking for a location for a second North American headquarters, cities across the country from Miami to Vancouver have leapt into action, hoping they can bring Amazon and its jobs to town, Melissa.
That's right, Tom. And it would be a great catch for any community. Now, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos grew up in South Florida and says he expects to invest $5 billion building his company's second headquarters, planning to hire 50,000 new employees with an average salary of more than $100,000.
Now, Amazon says it's looking for a city with a metropolitan area of at least 1 million people. It wants a stable and friendly business environment and a suburban or urban location. It'll take either one, but it wants to be able to attract and retain strong tech talent. Michael Finney is CEO and president of the Miami-Dade Beacon Council. It's an economic development group in South Florida, and it's one of the groups putting together South Florida's bid for Amazon's second headquarters. He told WPLG-TV in Miami it will be a community effort to lure Amazon south.
Well, I don't want to share our entire game plan for how we intend to go after it, but you can certainly expect that we will work with our private sector business leaders, our governmental business leaders, our nonprofit partners, and so we are in fact working to pull together the entire community to ensure that we have the best possible proposal.
Now, bids are due next Thursday, and Amazon is expected to announce the winner next year. The race to win the affections of Amazon includes incentives to attract the company, things like infrastructure improvements, road work, sewers, tax credits, and tax breaks. A new analysis finds Amazon has secured more than $1 billion in state and local government incentives nationwide, including millions here in Florida. The state's Business Journal's publications have been covering this story, and right now we're pleased to welcome two of them to the Florida Roundup with their analysis. Timothy Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal, and Deborah Lima of the South Florida Business Journal. Tim, let's start with you. Every major city in Florida appears to be making a bid, but with all the competition, what are the odds of Amazon actually coming to the Sunshine State?
That is a great and open question that there's not really an answer for yet. The bids are due on October 19th, and everybody's just kind of hoping, I think, at this point. It has to be said that in many ways, Florida does not necessarily fit some of the criteria that Amazon is looking for. What it's really going to come down to is the subject of this Amazon effect analysis that the business journals have done looking at incentives. Incentives are going to be a big part of how Amazon goes about making that decision.
Deborah Lima, what would you say are South Florida and Jacksonville's advantages and drawbacks to lure Amazon?
When it comes to South Florida, things are being done sort of differently here. Economic development agencies in three counties are coming together for a joint bid. So that shows off resources for the whole region rather than those of a single city. So that sort of tries to outweigh these deficits that Tim just pointed out. It's going to be an interesting approach that, if nothing else, is going to get Amazon's attention. South Florida has a large population, airports with direct flights coming out every single day, more than 12 universities, and most importantly, the deal that's going to be bringing a fulfillment center to Opa-locka show that we can play ball and fulfill certain demands that Amazon might have. I think the biggest gap is in mass transit.
Opa-locka is a small urban community in Miami-Dade County that has not seen a lot of economic development over many, many years. Let's put this to the listeners, Melissa. Do you support your tax money going to try to bring a Fortune 50 global multi-billion dollar company to your neighborhood? 305-995-1800. You probably spend a lot of money on Amazon. Would you like some of your tax money to go to help bring Amazon to your area? 305-995-1800. Deborah, how do these tax incentives, these government incentives, how have they worked for Amazon in communities in Florida that they are building in already?
So when it comes to South Florida, they're going to be getting $1.5 million in a tax incentive deal that will allow them to get a sort of tax break for a six-year period. And that's going to allow them to bring 1,000 jobs to Opa-locka.
What's the kind of tax break they're getting? On property taxes?
No, Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah.
It's an sort of all-encompassing tax deal. And the idea is that Miami-Dade County gets in exchange for that jobs and development in a part of the county that has been pretty much untouched. Opa-locka, the land where they're going to be building on, it hasn't been developed in about 45 years.
Hmm. And the number to join the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. What do you think, Florida? Should Amazon choose the Sunshine State for its HQ2, as it's called? And should it be your city? Should it be Tampa? Should it be South Florida? Should it be Jacksonville? Tim Gibbons, how have these city Amazon relationships played out across the country, and what would the impact be on the workforce in Florida as these warehouse projects take place?
Well, that relationship is an interesting question. I mentioned the Amazon effect analysis that we did, which basically looked at across the country, Amazon getting more than $1 billion in incentives from cities and states. Basically, one viewpoint is that Amazon almost plays cities and states off against each other to try to get the best deal they can get. You know, they're in business, and the more they can do to get public funding, the more it helps them. I know that we just discussed the incentives in South Florida. Here in Jacksonville, they got some $27 million in different incentives, tax breaks, training grants, roadway work, things like that. A lot of times you have Amazon comes in and does a great job of hiring thousands of workers. It can reshape the logistics industry in a town, and it employs a lot of people.
It really does. At the same time, Amazon's gotten some bad press.
They have.
In terms of conditions at some of its fulfillment centers.
That has
100-degree temperatures,
yes.
Difficult, long shifts. It's gotten some negative press. What about that as well?
It has. One of the ways the company has dealt with that is by investing more in robotics. To a certain extent, the warehouses have been better workplaces for a robot than for a human being. You have a robot that can operate in those sort of temperatures, it's not going to complain. Some of their warehouses, the actual aisles between rows have been narrowed. Human beings can't fit down them, but these Kiva robots that Amazon has, it's designed for them. So one of the open questions is, sure, they hire a lot of people, but will they be employing that number of people long-term, or at some point, is it a mostly automated sort of facility?
That's a good question, Tom. You know, how many jobs really in the end would the new HQ2 bring?
Right, and the types of jobs, certainly. We've seen the warehouse developments, the distribution-type developments, Deborah, that Amazon has gotten incentives for in North Florida and here in South Florida and in other places. It can be hundreds up to 1,000 jobs. But how sustainable are those jobs? What kind of wages are we talking about?
Yeah, I think what's important to note is that the way that these deals work out, they're done pretty quickly. Amazon has pretty strong demands about timeline. They want things to be up and running before the holiday season when things really pick up. And it seems as though elected officials and economic development agencies are given little time to consider those things. In Opa-locka, people are going to be paid between $24,000 and $27,000, give or take, including or excluding incentives, and the median,
which is roughly half of what the median income is.
Exactly.
Right.
Some will argue that a job is better than no job, but that's certainly up for debate. And it's as though there wasn't enough time to consider that part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to the calls here, Melissa. 305-995-1800. You probably shop quite a bit on Amazon, but what about some of your tax dollars going to bring Amazon, an Amazon facility, a warehouse, a distribution facility, even perhaps the second headquarters in North America to your town? Is that something you support? 305-995-1800. We'll begin in South Florida in Miramar with Jose. Jose, you are on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to ask the questions. Well, I was actually asking, with the median house cost between the $350,000 and so on, are we as a city prepared to bring Amazon here? I mean, with more as congested as we are, we need to think about development. But we're going to house all these people.
So, great question, Jose. What do we know about what Amazon is pledging, if anything, to whatever community happens to win its affections for this second headquarters, Tim? Do we know how many workers it plans on bringing with it?
They've talked about the number of workers, but there hasn't been a lot of discussion about what else they would do. And you know, we should be clear that Amazon, when they move into an area, does make obviously investments there. They build the warehouses. Here in Jacksonville, there was one of the incentives that they received was help with a road. Where Amazon itself also chipped in roughly $5 million for this $17 million road. So the company does invest kind of in at the same time that there's the public taxpayer money investment, mm-hmm. there's also Amazon's investment. Obviously, if you get something like HQ2, I think that that's such a unique sort of project that it's really hard to extrapolate from other things they've done to say what would they do, in much the same way that it's hard to extrapolate from the city standpoint of you have cities across the country that are going all out doing all sorts of things because this is a once-in-a-generational sort of thing.
Yeah, they're doing crazy stunts. It's funny to see Birmingham installing three giant Amazon delivery boxes all over their city to try to get this coup. It's funny, the pulling out all the stops, you know. Let's go to Carolina in Kendall. Hi, Carolina. You're on the Florida Roundup.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Doing great. Thanks. Go ahead.
So my comment, I work in logistics. I work primarily in transportation in North America. And my biggest concern is how bringing a big distributor like Amazon, who has the money to pay, how that's going to flip the transportation market in terms of trucking, just as basic as that. Now all of our mom-and-pop locations are going to have to start paying more in order to compete and be able to win that truck, which right now already, with the trucking market being completely super tight, it's a 5.5 ratio to every truck. So every 5.5 loads, there's only one truck right now in the United States that will take that. So that's my biggest concern. And is Amazon, do we know if they're switching over to like assets where they're buying their own trucks, or are they going to be competing in that as well?
Amazon has made a number of moves in the logistics space, and it's interesting if you chart public company conference calls. You go back a couple years and everybody would talk about how Google was the thing they were afraid of. And at this point, you have Amazon rising in popularity on the fear index. Basically, companies saying that this is the thing that could most disrupt their business. In part, that's because Amazon really has jumped into a bunch of different things. We often refer to them as a tech company or a retail company. They're bidding to be called a logistics company as well, operating their own fleet of actual assets.
They've even gotten into, of course, video production and film production as well. So,
exactly,
delivering your hot latte from a drone. Who knows what's next here? But Deborah,
not doing public radio yet.
Not quite yet. No, thankfully not. We got a nice moat around what we're doing here in public radio. But Deborah, ripple effect that that Carolina voices concern about local companies on the logistics side, but we've seen that even just on the retailing side.
Yeah, I mean, I think when Tim says that Amazon's fear factor and the kind of worry that it's inspiring in other companies is very true, because with them, the sky is sort of the limit. They started off as a bookseller, and now they sell car tires and diapers. And if you ask about trucks, it's possible you're not even thinking far long enough, because they are looking into drones and they have all of these robots. And so they could really be threatening any space. So people should really be attuned to the kind of force that Amazon will bring as it continues to grow. And I don't think it'll even be limited to the United States. Soon they'll be going to Latin America. There are reports that they're bringing online shopping to Brazil. And so that's actually one of the things that they're thinking about when it comes to HQ2. South Florida is pretty well positioned for that kind of thing. So
I'm trying to make the case there for South Florida, it sounds like, here on the Florida Roundup. Amazon, its second headquarters, the bid for that, and the $1 billion in government subsidies that Amazon has been able to secure from governments throughout the country to bring their distribution and warehouse centers to town. That's what we're talking about here. Melissa, we're going to go to Richard on line 5 in Miami. Hi, Richard. You are on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I have both a comment and a question. As far as the Beacon Council, in the past 20 years, I really haven't seen them being able to bring in any large company of any kind or medium size. And many of the companies, sorry, that's on the background. And many of the companies, what their role has been fairly marginal. So I'm wondering what might be different this time that they could be instrumental in bringing them here.
Sure.
And then the follow-up question to that is, clearly what they're going to want is a potential employment pool, people that work in high tech and have extensive experience in that, which cities like Austin do have. So that, I have to assume, is going to be a big obstacle, because I don't think we're known in that area at all.
Richard, great point.
Those are my two questions.
Let's go to that first question. The Beacon Council is the Miami-Dade County Economic Development Group. All the large counties in Florida have versions of that that are public-private partnerships that really work to attract jobs. Deborah and Tim, what do we know about what these bids that these groups are putting together, really right now? They're due next Thursday. Mm-hmm. What do we know how they look?
Yeah, so like I said, it's going to be a combination with the Beacon Council and the Greater Fort Lauderdale Alliance in Broward and the Palm Beach Development Board. They're going to be working together to really play up the things that are strong about South Florida. And I mentioned population, airports, universities, that kind of thing. The big piece that they're really going to have to iron out is mass transit. Anyone in South Florida will tell you that mobility is an issue.
Yeah.
When it comes to tech talent, it'll be, I think, a mix between attracting the talent that's being groomed in our universities, which have been ramping up their computer science degree programs and things of that sort, and kind of a if you build it, they will come mentality that attracts people from all over the world.
I think that last point that Deborah made is probably a key one, as a lot of cities look at attracting this. Arguably, nobody has, or very few places have, the homegrown talent already in place that they need. And if you look at a lot of these bids, they tend to be a here's what we have and everything else that you want we can get. Jacksonville has a similar sort of partnership that's working together to push the city for this. The State Economic Development Office is actually coordinating something between Miami, Jacksonville, Florida, Orlando, and Tampa, mm-hmm. Trying to get a broad-based, you know, come to the state, look at all of our good cities. But it's kind of clear that none of these cities in Florida have everything that yeah. Amazon has on its wish list.
So a high bar to clear, but they're going to give it their best possible effort.
It will be a prime attempt.
Yeah. But, well, it'll be interesting to see, Tom. I mean, we'll know in 2018.
Yeah, but it's coming at a time, yeah. Tim, in our final moments here, coming at a time where government incentives have been frowned upon by the Republican legislature, and the governor really had to go to the 11th inning in this last legislative cycle in order to secure a pot of money that he can use to try to lure jobs here that aren't in the 1,000 range like they are for Amazon.
And that was one of the interesting things with this American Cities Business Journal project, looking at the incentives, is this idea that they're going out there, they're happening on a local scale, so we kind of brought it together on a national sort of look, because there is a sort of changing tide. It used to be Republican orthodoxy was, you know, you give money to businesses to have them come and set up, and that very much has changed in the minds of our legislatures.
Well, thank you so much. Really great insights from both of you. Timothy Gibbons with the Jacksonville Business Journal, Deborah Lima with the South Florida Business Journal, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup, the statewide edition. We'll be right back.
I'm Robert Siegel. The mid-19th century was great for literature, not so great for surgery.
The operating table isn't washed down between patients. The instruments aren't washed down. The hands of the surgeons aren't being washed. So it was actually really horrific.
That is, until one British surgeon got the other doctors to clean up. The story of Joseph Lister this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News. Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
This week in This American Life, Alex is stranded on an island. No cell phone, no food, his boat's out of gas. And he's just across the water from New York City. You can see planes landing.
You can see skyscrapers, and on the other side, you can die looking at them, you know? Like, and also, I got a little mad at the city of New York. Like, I could understand if they had just one payphone there.
This week.
Saturdays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we give the White House some advice on fighting terrorism and basic incompetence.
If the government is good at things, I can tell you this, they're not good at this.
Can politicians and eggheads play nice together? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the Florida Roundup statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Emory Jones was 14 when he started breaking into homes in Broward County. He was caught in 2011, and a judge sent him to a youth detention program in Polk County. While he was there, Jones says a worker, Uriah Harris, regularly used a broom for beating kids.
A mark right there.
Is that a mark from what he did to you?
Yeah. You know, he gonna make sure you don't go to the hospital. It don't show, like, later on, you're like, ooh, boy, I got you good. Let me see that there.
Jones has a faint scar above his left elbow as a reminder of what happened at Avon Park Youth Academy. His claim is part of a 2-year investigation into the state's Department of Juvenile Justice by the Miami Herald. The investigation finds systemic abuse of teens in state custody. Now, the system, Melissa, is designed to rehabilitate kids who get into trouble. It includes state-run detention centers and commitment programs that are privately operated but funded and overseen by the state of Florida.
Over the past decade, hundreds of children in the care of the Department of Juvenile Justice have suffered abuse and neglect, sometimes at the hands of officers actually hired to help rehabilitate them. The abuse uncovered by the Herald includes officers bribing kids with snacks so that they would be encouraged to beat each other up. It's unbelievable. And just so unbelievable to read about. Josie Ashton worked in DJJ facilities for 3.5 years. She was brought in to train incoming employees on how to interact with children.
I laugh because it was really disturbing at times. Their hiring practices is basically, if you can breathe and talk and walk, yeah, we want you here. You know, you willing to take $8.50, $9 an hour? Sure, come work with us. But do understand that you may have to work doubles.
Now, the head of Florida's juvenile justice system says the Herald's investigation doesn't tell the full story. Juvenile Justice Secretary Christy Daly told state lawmakers at a budget meeting in Tallahassee on Wednesday,
"I will not deny or discredit or downplay some of the horrible incidents that have happened. We respond appropriately to those. We hold people accountable. If we need to change policies and procedures, we do so. But it is not representative of this system."
Carol Marvin Miller is the lead reporter for the Miami Herald investigation entitled Fight Club. She joins us here on the Florida Roundup. Carol, it's great to have you here on the radio. So the secretary of the DJJ, the Department of Juvenile Justice, told state lawmakers that this is not representative of this system. Is it?
Yeah, I think it is. We spent about 2 years looking into what was going on within both the state-run lockups and the privately operated commitment facilities. We gathered hundreds of incident reports and investigations. We looked at videos. We pulled police reports, court records. And what we found was that these abuses that we wrote about were indeed going on all over the state of Florida and had been for a number of years.
Did you find a pervasive or lack of regulation or some kind of shadow policy that encouraged this kind of awful behavior?
No, I don't think that anybody in state government encouraged these types of abuses. I think instead what we found was a pervasive neglect where the private providers and even the folks who work in the state facilities felt empowered to not report wrongdoing as is required, to occasionally falsify records. And when those things occurred, they were investigated and people were terminated, but they occurred with great regularity. And we quoted a fellow who had been a juvenile justice administrator in another state saying that what that leads to is a sense among the youths that they are at the mercy of staff, that when staff feels empowered to engage in wrongdoing, the kids have no recourse. Yeah.
And if you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup. Call into the show from anywhere in Florida. The number, 305-995-1800. What are your questions about the Miami Herald investigation, Fight Club, into a horrifying story into the Department of Juvenile Justice? Carol, hearing that adults that were actually in charge of rehabilitating youth were actually incentivizing them, giving them treats to try to encourage them to fight each other. This is something in particular, I think, that will horrify your readers. And could you also describe this practice of honey bunning? What's that all about, honey bunning?
In August of 2015, a 17-year-old boy by the name of Elord Revolt was beaten to death in the lockup in Miami. And we wanted to find out why that was. We discovered that it was indicative of a practice called honey bunning, in which officers and youth workers will offer children treats, honey buns, hamburgers, Snickers bars, to outsource discipline. Well, why does that happen? At times, officers don't want to get their hands dirty. They don't want to beat up a kid themselves because then they would be at risk of losing their job. So they outsource the discipline, and they will say, well, that kid over there has a honey bun on his head, or there's a bounty on his head, or the guard will put out what's called the honey bun hit. The practice has developed a huge nomenclature. We found in some places in Florida, officers would use the cue 30 seconds, which was their way of saying, I will turn my back for that long and you can beat up that kid before I turn my back around again. Or in I think it was Palm Beach County, in a facility, they would yell, youth support. And that was a cue for kids to round up a detainee who was the target, pull him into a room, and pummel him.
My God. And so this was done, as you say, with impunity. There was no real oversight. No one watching the watchers, correct?
Yes and no. In the cases that were identified and investigated, we would regularly see officers, individual officers, who were fired for their role in this kind of activity, although not always, because in some cases the investigation would conclude it's the word of the youths against that of the officer, and the officer's word almost always was given greater weight. What we found was lacking was any view from 40,000 feet, where an administrator in Tallahassee would look at these cases as they piled up over time, see the patterns and the similarities as we did, and issue some kind of forceful memo that said, we will not tolerate this. If you do it, you will not only be fired, you'll be prosecuted.
So when the Juvenile Justice Secretary, Christy Daly, told state lawmakers this week, I will not deny or discredit or downplay some of the horrible incidents that have happened. We respond appropriately to those. We hold people accountable. Do they?
Yes. When on those occasions where an investigation into a restraint was made and an officer was determined to be responsible, generally he or she would be fired. But again, you can't govern a system as if every event that occurs, an incident of wrongdoing, is seen only as an isolated incident. You have to connect the dots, you have to see the patterns, and you have to react to them.
The lack of a comprehension of the kind of culture that is and still is in these detention centers for these teenagers, Carol?
As far as I know, yeah. As recently as last winter, a youth in Broward County was seen getting the snot beat out of him in the dining hall in the lockup in Fort Lauderdale. I got a tip about that case. I interviewed the youth's father, and I said, well, what happened? And the answer I got startled me. The father said, I saw my son in the hospital. He had a nose that was broken in two places. And the father said, well, what happened to you? And the son's answer was, this kid over there was talking trash, and I complained to the officer, and the officer said, punch him when no one's looking. And the officer, for some reason, got angry at that kid, threw him to the ground and punched him in the nose repeatedly, breaking the kid's nose in two places.
We're speaking with Carol Marvin Miller, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald, behind the series Fight Club, detailing violence in Florida's juvenile justice system. 305-995-1800 in Jacksonville. Alexandria, you've been holding on. Thank you. Your thoughts, your experiences here.
Hi. I'm calling just because when I was younger, from the ages of probably like 13, well, 17, I had been in on and off trouble. I was incarcerated at the Duval County, like, detention center there. From what, like, I learned in there was just so many issues with all of it. The girls in there, I noticed we didn't have as many fights. A lot of the female officers were actually pretty great, and we weren't really allowed to have male officers in our unit, just to lower the risk of sexual assault, I guess. But even then, there's officer there that would offer candy for sexual favors, and if you didn't want to do these things, they'd make sure to punish you. We only got like 15-minute phone calls once a week, and even then, they threatened to take it away from us. I know in the boys' unit, they had so many more issues. I've watched officers, like, tell the boys to do something to the girl when we'd be walking down the hallway at the same time, and then they would tackle the boy for actually doing it. I remember, I think it was my first time there, I was sitting in their processing room, and there was another, like, young man in there, and he kept harassing me. He was, like, threatening to rape me, and said that he enjoyed raping girls and all this other stuff. And the officer that was in there that was doing our processing, she just ignored it. And when I got up and moved away, she threatened to call multiple guards in there to take me to confinement, and just never did anything about this boy threatening to rape me when I was 13, 14 years old. If you complain to them and it makes their job harder, they're going to make your life harder. They don't really care about your well-being, even though you're a child and they're supposed to be there to help you. They don't want to do anything. They just want to sit there and play on their phones, or they just want to sit there, watch TV, or do whatever. It's not anywhere safe to be. They don't care. That's the main issue.
Wow.
Alexandria, thanks for sharing your story. We hope that you're doing better now and off to much better things. Melissa, really a heartbreaking story there from Duval County.
Yeah, it is. And you know, Carol, hearing that is upsetting. I'm not surprised to hear that the boys' area is more violent than the girls. But, you know, as I'm hearing about what you uncovered, something else that's going through my mind is that this is not new for Florida. Your investigation uncovered shocking information, but it's not the first time we've heard about this in the state's juvenile justice system. There have been attempts at reform before. So that's what's doubly frustrating, I think, for your readers to think through, is that this is not a new failure for the system in Florida, is it?
No. I started at the Miami Herald in the year 2000, and the first week I began, I got a tip about a child who was in a shelter in Broward County, the Lippman Shelter, who had hanged himself and had been allowed to remain hanging from his black leather belt while a staffer took pictures of him with her Polaroid camera for liability reasons. And that child was not cut down until the police arrived moments later. We wrote about that extensively, and it became an interest of mine. It really tugged at me for the next 17 years. Yeah. And we've had periodic spasms of these terrible, terrible stories. Omar Paisley in Miami, who suffered with raging appendicitis for 3 days, died of a burst appendix while guards and nurses accused him of being a faker and refused to get him medical care. Martin Anderson in Bay County, who was restrained to death in a boot camp. These are not rare incidents, and the legislature will react when they occur and will promise reform, but they repeat with really disturbing regularity.
We're going to go back to your phone calls here in a moment, but let me say you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Matthew in Jacksonville, you're up next. Thanks for holding on. Your thoughts here, Matthew.
Well, the thoughts that I have on this is, one, it's just absolutely appalling and unacceptable. I mean, I'm a member of the armed forces, and I've been in for 5 years now. And to hear about something like that for the state of Florida that's had years of evidence, I mean, the state legislature's commentary was that, oh, this is incongruitive of our system, this doesn't represent us. I would say that's a direct objection, and it sounds like she's trying to cover her tail. Because if this is something that investigators have found years worth of consistent evidence of kids being abused, kids being raped, kids being just flat-out assaulted, that's just flat-out unacceptable. It's appalling for something like that, and I don't want people to hear fire. Well, my question is, all honesty, who in the flying heck is going to be arrested for doing this to children? This is unacceptable.
Yeah, forget about losing their job, Carol. What about being prosecuted for any of these?
Prosecution is very rare. We found cases where officers or youth workers were charged criminally with sexual misconduct or with battery. But the more common reaction was to do nothing in the court system. And again, they're one of the issues that I think mitigates against prosecution is the tendency to value the word of the grown-ups more than that of the kids. And we found that again and again and again where cops, police officers, or prosecutors would look at a set of facts and say, well, it's the word of those kids there worth it versus that officer or those officers there, and the investigation would go nowhere. And that's true, by the way, even in instances where there were pretty good videos that showed wrongdoing.
Visual evidence of it. And the response from prosecutors in those cases?
We weren't really able to talk with prosecutors for the most part. You're not going to get a whole lot of assistant state attorneys were willing to talk to you about.
Do you have time quickly to tell us about the Missouri model that has worked to change some of these abusive practices?
Sure. One of the things that surprised us was that the conservative law and order state of Missouri had developed probably the most progressive reforms in the country. Their model is to bring kids back home, living in their communities in group homes, small settings. It is not a correctional model. It's a rehabilitative model that is focused on treating the causes of these kids offending and not punishing them.
Carol Marvin Miller, lead investigator for the Miami Herald's Fight Club investigation into violence at juvenile justice detention centers throughout the state of Florida, also reported it for Florida Public Radio. Thanks so much, Carol, for sharing your work with all of us here in the state of Florida.
Thanks for having me.
We've got plenty more to come. You are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
Damage to tropical forests is making global warming worse.
The threats are mainly anthropogenic. The first one is deforestation, but for the first time, we were able to quantify the losses due also to degradation and disturbance.
How the tropics went from soaking up carbon to releasing it. I'm Steve Hurwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Sunday afternoons at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
Tristan Harris once had a successful career in Silicon Valley trying to manipulate your attention. And then he became disenchanted.
And so you started to see technology not as a vehicle for improving people's lives, but really as a means to persuade people to do things.
I'm Guy Raz. Ideas about manipulation? That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sundays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Famed primatologist Jane Goodall's observations have revolutionized our understanding of chimps and primates. I'm John Dankosky. On the next Science Friday, we talk with Goodall about her experience living in solitude among the chimps of Tanzania and challenging the conventions of science. Plus, the debate about what makes a finding statistically significant. A look at revising the p-value. That's on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. More than 1.5 million people in Florida, Melissa, buy their health insurance through healthcare.gov. That's the national marketplace for the Affordable Care Act. 90% of those Floridians do not pay the full premium because they qualify for the government subsidy, reducing their out-of-pocket monthly expense for that health coverage.
That's right. Now, late yesterday, President Trump said he was ending one of the government subsidies designed to help lower-income Americans purchase affordable health insurance. The president is ending the cost-sharing reductions, the payments that go to insurance companies. Now, this is different than the subsidy 90% of Floridians who buy their insurance on healthcare.gov get to lower their monthly premiums. But doing away with the cost-sharing reductions, or CSRs, as the insurance industry calls them, could trigger higher premiums for all of us. Here to tell us more, we welcome reporter Sammy Mack of WLRN and Julio Ochoa, Health News Florida editor. He joins us from WUSF in Tampa. Julio, a Florida Blue rep gave you a statement about the president's move this morning. What does the company have to say about all this?
Yes, well, first, Florida Blue says it's not going anywhere. They will continue to offer plans in 2018 because they anticipated that these cost-sharing subsidies were not going to go, or were not going to be there in 2018. So they had already thought that they were going to go away, so they had increased the premiums for next year's plans by about 40%. The way this decision really hurts insurance companies are the ones who were covering Affordable Care Act plans this year. They will have to fund these reductions or the subsidies for the remaining months of the year, and they haven't received any reductions or any subsidies since August. So basically 4 months of this year, they're going to go without these subsidies. And Florida Blue covers about 1 million people in Florida, and last year these subsidies paid for roughly $1.3 billion. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a big chunk. I mean, it's inevitable, isn't it, that this is going to be passed on to the consumer in the form of higher premiums. Florida's Office of Insurance Regulation, they came out with insurance rates last month for the six major insurers who sell on the federal exchange here in Florida, the Obamacare exchange. They all requested double-digit rate hikes at an average increase of 45%. So what can all of us as consumers of insurance expect?
Well, the way the Affordable Care Act is written, when premiums increase, when insurance companies increase premiums, the subsidies from the federal government also must increase. So the way it works out, most consumers on the marketplace will only see small increases to their premiums. Some could actually see their premiums go down by very slight amounts. So if you're an average consumer, you're not going to feel the big hit from this, these premium increases initially. But as more people start to leave the marketplace and the risk pool goes up and more insurers start to leave, then the premiums will start to increase beyond even more, and we might see insurers pull out, and then the sickest and the elderly will not have anywhere to get insurance.
We are talking about the Affordable Care Act and the cost-sharing reductions, the elimination of those announced by President Trump late yesterday. Could it affect your health care premium in Florida? Your thoughts about the cost of your care here in the Sunshine State, 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800 from throughout the state of Florida. Sammy Mack, let me ask you, Julio said $1.3 billion of these cost reduction, cost-sharing reductions come into the state of Florida. That's 20%, 20 cents of every dollar nationwide of these cost-sharing reductions come into the state of Florida. Is the risk here with the elimination of these, certainly on the premium that Obamacare recipients have to pay, but also whether or not they're going to have care or even a choice of companies in 2018 to choose from?
Yeah, that is one of the things that everybody is watching right now. And just backing up a little bit, because healthcare has its own language, the premium is the thing that you pay every month.
Right.
And this cost sharing reduction money that was going to the insurance companies was kind of like a two-step dance that helped helped pay for that monthly cost for a consumer, and it also covered a few other things within that. It didn't go directly to consumers, it went to the insurance companies. So it's taking it away from the insurance companies, but technically not immediately anyway, taking it away from the people who are buying the plans. And that is where the concern is, that on a long enough timeline, the insurance companies are going to shift that cost to the consumers as they buy new plans in the next couple of years. And so the question is, will the insurance companies want to participate in that market if those costs are going to go up so much? Especially if, you know, if the costs go up, why buy a plan on the market? Because we may also start seeing, the president indicated he wants to see more out of marketplace plans, mm-hmm. other options, some of the sorts of things that you used to see before the Affordable Care Act that would have potentially different designs, maybe not cover as many things, but be the sorts of products that would be attractive to a young, healthy person who doesn't feel like they need all the bells and whistles, which would mean that the people left buying insurance in the marketplace could potentially be sicker. They could be people who are just more expensive. They could be people with chronic conditions, people who are cancer survivors, people who have diabetes.
More expensive to provide health services and more expensive to insure as well. Mm-hmm. You are listening to the Florida Roundup State Edition from Florida Public Radio.
Julio Ochoa, you know, President Trump expressed a lot of disappointment and anger that Congress was unable to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Is this just another way to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, do you think? Just another way to kind of pull it down, weaken it, sort of get at the structure of it so that it slowly unwinds?
I mean, absolutely. Thursday was a really bad day for the Affordable Care Act, right? We've had the president sign the executive order that critics say will pull younger and healthier consumers out of the marketplace, what Sammy was talking about earlier, and then he announces that these subsidies will no longer be there. This comes after he slashed the budget for navigators, who are the people who help people sign up for the marketplace, and reduced advertising for the plans, and then he also cut, or the Trump administration cut, the time to sign up for these plans from 90 days to 45 days. So
and not on
it's
Sunday
all
evenings.
Working.
And not on Sunday
right,
nights.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
The
website is going to be under maintenance on Sunday nights in the sort of like late afternoon, evening hours.
What about the Spanish language website? Spanish language signups, we know, have been significant, certainly in South Florida, in yet another area, Julio, that is kind of, you know, potentially constraining the number of folks that may wind up signing up for the Affordable Care Act in 2018.
That's right. They're all going to feel the impact of this loss in advertising and the loss in the navigators who actually help people sign up. Their job was so important to get people to understand what these health plans, health insurance plans are all about and how to sign up for them. So, yeah, I mean, are we seeing the downward spiral? That's the question.
And it is, there is sort of a space that you can look to and sort of wonder, like, okay, is this where this is going? Because there have been groups who have been small populations of people, and some of them are larger than others, who have been left out of the Affordable Care mm-hmm. Act. And that includes people who were, you know, caught in the Medicaid gap
right.
and were not eligible for these subsidies. And that's a population that makes a little bit less than the people who were getting these subsidies. And for them, that is a group that has found insurance on the marketplace, by and large, inaccessible. And so there is a question, is that going to be representative of how people interact with the market in the future if the rates go up and if this isn't an option for them, if this cost sharing doesn't help them?
Julio, if you could just describe the environment for 2018. November 1st, I believe, is when open enrollment is due to begin for the Affordable Care Act nationwide, including here in Florida. What's that environment look like for folks that have relied on the ACA over the past couple of years for their coverage?
Well, it is a question that we're asking our sources out there. Do people even know that the Affordable Care Act is still in place? I mean, there's been all this confusion, all this uncertainty, all the talk about the repeal and replace. So first of all, heading into this shortened enrollment period, do people even know that the Affordable Care Act is still there for them? And they don't have as many navigators to help them to learn about it or the advertising to know about it. So that's the marketplace we're heading into. And then you have
talk. Thank you both. Sammy Mack of WLRN, Julio Ochoa, Health News Florida editor, both joining us. Thanks. Finally on the roundup. Have you seen those new uniforms for the University of Florida Gators football team? Have you seen those, Tom?
Yeah, I have to admit that I have, Melissa. You know, the usual UF colors of orange and blue, they don't exactly conjure up the school's Gator mascot. But these new football uniforms, at least for tomorrow night's game against Texas A&M, certainly will.
Yeah, they are swamp green, and they're supposed to look like gator skin with scales. Now, they're the result of UF working with Nike for a year and a half to create the new look. They're for one night only when the Aggies visit the swamp. But, Tom, the social media reaction to the gator uniforms has been merciless. Here are just a couple of the mean tweets we saw. Florida needs to stick to being bad at football and leave the uniforms to Oregon. And Florida will wear the worst uniforms in the history of Western civilization Saturday. Ouch. Ugh. Well, that's our program for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Murchard are producers.
Jason Zabka is our technical director with help from Peter Maris. Our theme music is by Miami musician Aaron Libos.
I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and thanks for listening.